Chapter 17. For Lost Time. Roshan walked casually through the halls of the palace, not even pausing as he inspelled the guards to ignore him. He had come up from the dungeons and proceeded directly to the residential portions of the palace. The building was ancient, and there had been no significant remodeling done in the 100 winters he had been gone. The decor had changed somewhat, a combination of evolving fashions and the personal taste of the current emperor, Darris, of whom Roshan knew little. Emperor Darris was a recluse by all accounts, preferring solitude and holding court infrequently, letting his advisors run the day-to-day dealings of the empire. He would appear at his balcony to make proclamations and speeches, then retreat to his quarters, or more frequently his country estates. Roshan was guessing that he would make at least a token appearance at the bygone's night festivities, however. Roshan had been focused when he arrived in Cadrus, but not so much so that he had overlooked the obvious celebratory preparations going on in the city. Times changed, but bygone's festival was still one of the favorite holidays in the empire. Tradition held that the emperor had no rival, no adversary to placate once in autumn. Thus, he attended any function of bygone's festival in his normal royal garb. In some ways, it isolated a man in an already lonely position at the highest level of power in the empire to not truly take part in the revels that his subjects enjoyed so much. However, it was too much to pass up the sight of so many of the important personages of the empire making asses of themselves, impersonating one another. Roshan had every intention of crashing the party that was to be held in the palace that evening. The building thrummed with excited energy as the main ballroom was decorated for the occasion. Food and drink from the finest merchants in Cadran were brought in and set out in buffets. Coming up through the dungeons was easy enough, but in the upper levels of the palace, the bustle of so many people made staying unnoticed difficult. He had to quickly hide the shabby clothes he wore before he drew attention. He transformed them into a messenger's outfit, much the same way he had made them look like a warlock's ensemble earlier at the Tower of Contemplation. A messenger who walked purposefully and looked like he knew where he was going was seldom interrupted. Roshan did have a purpose, and most certainly knew where he was going. It was a matter of what he would find when he got there. He found his destination at the end of a hall that was seldom visited. The floors were kept clean, but there was little other reason to come down this way. The door in front of him was outlined in runes, both on the door and on the stone frame it was set in. The two lines of runes matched up, with identical symbols on each, directly across from one another. A faint, subtle pull of ether fed the magic of the door's locking spell. Unlike the crude cell down in the dungeons, this work was a masterpiece. While it was not designed to harm anyone, it was a bit of self-regenerating magic, an ether construct that would repair and renew itself rather than slowly give way to the passage of time, weakening until it ultimately failed. Roshan wove a complicated web of ether, touching just the right places at the right times. It was so ingrained in him that he did it with hardly a conscious thought. This was his room. It was much as he remembered leaving it the day he departed with the Red Riders for Farron's Plain. There were the discarded clothes he had worn the day before, ready to fall apart with age. The wardrobe stood open. Upon the shelves was a collection of books, a few of which he had written himself. Blast, he thought. Someone got in here. There was a book missing, and after a moment's thought, Roshan knew which it was. The Warlock Prophecies was gone from its spot. The immortal warlock sighed deeply. He hoped that the book had not caused any trouble. Roshan had always possessed a dark sense of humor. In his younger days, when he was feeling annoyed with someone he could not justify killing, he would often retire to his room and write prophecy. Roshan had no gift of foresight, but it was cathartic to write of doom and woe in the most cryptic and vague ways he thought someone might someday believe. As he wrote them, he took his petty vengeance on the generations yet unborn who believed in prophecy and would get what they deserved for reading his. He had always hated prophecies and the passive, helpless thinking they engendered. Rashan carved his own history with steel and ether, and the thought that fate or some unknown agent of the universe controlled his actions was anathema to him. In those younger days, he had taken a sinister glee in the thought that weak-minded fools one day would follow his prophecies as some sort of grand revelation that could save them from the dooms they predicted, if only they deciphered them. Now he just hoped that whoever had broken into his room and stolen it had not taken it seriously. He could not recall everything he had written, but some of it likely applied to the current era. The entry into his room had been no small feat. Whoever had managed it must have studied the locking ether construct extensively. There were a number of steps required to disarm the layers upon layers of ether guarding the construct. It would have been simpler to have confronted the wards guarding the physical structure of the door and just blasted off its hinges. The latter would have required considerable power in its own right, but was far less complicated and painstaking. However, Rashan had not built any means of inflicting harm into the door's protections. It was in the middle of the palace, after all, and he had no reason to harm overly curious palace staff or mischievous young sorcerers. It was simply a matter of ensuring the sanctity of his own privacy, and if forced to admit it, to show off how well he could craft it. Whoever had broken in had certainly earned himself a modicum of respect from the warlock. To take on the tedious task of figuring out the lock rather than the idiot's method of caving in the door bespoke someone who also wished to show off their cleverness. However, to have taken, near as he could tell, only the prophetic writings damped that respect markedly. Rashan double-checked the rest of the room. His recollections were a century old, and while he possessed a good memory, time played tricks with even an immortal's past. Still worried he might have overlooked something missing, he concluded that it was probably just the book. What Rashan had really come to his old room for was easily found. On a special rack made just to hold it hung his formal garb, identical to the robes and cloak he had imitated before the inner circle. These were the genuine article. The tunic was of a rare spider silk that was naturally black and shimmered iridescent in certain lighting. The gold trim was actually gold-infused thread, and the red trim got its color from ruby dust. The cloak was dragonhide, with meteoric iron pauldrons that were trimmed in plated gold. The pauldrons were joined together in the front and back as a single piece, and Rashan pulled them over his head as he finished changing. Rashan reached under the back of his collar and pulled his long hair free where it had been caught under the cloak, shaking it loose and letting it fall back into place. He stepped over to the mirror and casually swept away a century's worth of dust that had accumulated, using a small wind called up from the ether. He looked himself over critically. He looked younger than the last time he had seen himself in that mirror, the wrinkles at the corners of his eyes gone, along with the dark circles that often hung below them. His hair was pure white now as opposed to blonde and gray, and covered all the areas it had formerly retreated from. Age had been kind to the exceptional materials his warlock's gear was crafted from, but not nearly so generous as the gifts immortality had granted him. Still, two items were missing. The boots Rashan had preferred were lost at the Battle of Farron's Plain. Fine. Battle of the Dead Earth, if that is what they insist on calling it. They were a practical pair, suitable to the dirty work of fighting necromancers, unlike the finery he had just donned. He had no other pair like them. Walking barefoot over to the bed, he reached under and found a nice pair of house slippers that looked enough like soft shoes to avoid embarrassment, and slipped them on. The last piece he was missing was hovering in the air over its sheath, which hung from a pair of hooks in the wall just below it. Ah, Avalanche. How long has it been? Too long, I think. Grasping the hilt, he pulled the sword from its perch atop nothingness. The blade had a bluish tint to its steel, but the blade and crosspiece were otherwise not unusual for a broadsword. He gave it a couple effortless sweeps through the air, holding it in one hand, though in battle he had always used two. He He was much stronger now than he had been as a mortal. The changes he had wrought in his body were more than cosmetic. He was careful to avoid hitting anything with the blade. Avalanche was a weapon that was difficult to impede. He could put it through the wall if he was not careful with it. He let the blade go for a moment, and it resumed hovering exactly where it was left. To test its enchantment, Roshan leaned heavily against the flat of the blade and could not feel the slightest give to it. Satisfied, he retrieved the sheath from the wall and buckled it to his belt. Taking control of the sword once more, he slid it into its sheath with a satisfying snick. Only in its sheath, or when wielded, could Avalanche be moved. Walking back to the mirror, he rechecked his appearance. The shoes were not very noticeable, he was relieved to find. The sword seemed lacking, though. While the workmanship was fine, and he had carried it habitually through much of his tenure as warlock, he knew that it was unimpressive to look at. The sword and hilt were finely crafted, but certainly no more so than most knights' blades. Whoever had crafted it ages ago had been primarily concerned with utility. Roshan had always appreciated that aspect of the sword since he had used it often and found it served its purpose admirably. For now, though, he wanted something showier, something that would cause a bit more of a stir. He wanted to retrieve Heaven's Cry. Making sure the door was secured behind him, its wards back to their silent sentry duty, he turned and set off to get it.
Well, that could have gone worse, I suppose, Brannis thought, feeling drained.
He had just returned from army headquarters and his meeting with General Sir Hurld and Sir Garibald, the commander of Cadran forces and his own commander, respectively. The older knight had thankfully been in his army uniform still, despite being expected at the palace shortly thereafter in foppish sorcerer's garb. They had listened to Brannis's accounting of the mission, the battle, and the return trip home in silence, not asking any questions until he had finished. That was when Sir Hurld revealed that Sir Lugrin had already reported in, and had a different take on Brannis's story. Lugrin had told Sir Hurld that the army had been unprepared for the goblins' arrival despite vain efforts to make them so. He reported that Iridan was unable to effectively counter the goblins' own sorcerers, and that many of their casualties were a direct result. He had complained about the efforts of carrying the stricken Iridan with them, when no effort was made to bring any of the fallen soldiers along, and of the time they had wasted with the delusional hermit that eventually claimed to be Warlock Roshan. Brannis's own account had agreed on all the wide-sweeping facts, but on the minor details and interpretations, Lugrin had disagreed entirely. While Sir Lugrin spoke well of Brannis's combat acumen, he had convinced the general that Brannis was unfit for command. Even though Brannis held a higher rank on the mission than Lugrin, Hurld chose to take the older, more veteran knight's word on the matter, especially since Brannis seemed to at least entertain the idea that the hermit they met might really be the former Cadran warlock. As he walked through the house and up to his room, Brannis could think of little aside from finding his bed and sleeping through the rest of Bygone's night. The growling of his stomach asserted itself, though, and he corrected his thought. He could think of little else but sneaking some food from the kitchen, heading up to his room to eat, and sleeping away the remainder of the evening. When he reached his room, carrying a battered turkey leg and a tankard of ale, he received a shock. Upon opening the door, he had seen that someone had stolen in. His heart raced as he realized that the sword on his bed was not Massacre. He rushed over to the bed, hastily setting his meal down on a side table, and looked to see what was there. Under some fragments that appeared to have once been the dragon-sculpted handle of Massacre, there was a note, written in a brusque, scratchy script. "I wanted my sword back. Take this one. I think you shall like it better anyway. Its name is Avalanche. Be careful with it until you have learned its tricks. It does not move unless sheathed or in hand. Uncle Roshan." Brannis felt dizzy.
What does he mean by my sword? Brennus picked up the broken pieces of the little dragon that used to perch at his hip. He tried fitting them back together and noticed that they were actually not the hilt of his sword, but had actually covered it. There was a hollowed-out area inside the sculpture that was the shape of a much thinner handle, one that would have been uncomfortably small for his large hands. It would seem to have been ideally suited to someone Rashan's size, though. He knew that trying to chase down the demon was pointless. He would not know what to do if he caught him. By the note, he bore Brennus no ill will, but confronting him would likely irritate him at the least. Brennus tried thinking back to when he had first met Rashan. Had he taken any particular interest in the sword? How soon had he recognized the weapon?
Have I really been carrying Heaven's Cry around all this time?
Ever curious, Brennus could not help but wonder about the new blade he had been given. He pulled Avalanche from its sheath on the bed and gave it a few experimental swings to test its weight. It felt like almost nothing in his hand. Probably a lightened weapon for a smaller swordsman, someone Rashan's size, Brennus mused. He swung it around hard a few times, making a whoom, whoom sound as it displaced the air. Brennus looked around the room for something to test it on, but his own armor, piled in a heap at the foot of his bed, was the best he could find. Not wanting to ding his armor, he gently tapped at the breastplate with Avalanche. Crunch! The sword smashed the breastplate against the floor and took a fist-sized chunk out of the stone. Startled, he dropped the sword and leaped back from it. The sword did not fall, but stayed point down, angled to the floor just as he had left it. More cautious this time, he grabbed the hilt and picked it up again, and then let it go in midair. Again it stayed. Accepting the fact that he could do little about the demon's desire for Heaven's Cry, Brennus brightened his mood by playing with Avalanche, seeing what it was capable of. As darkness fell over the city of Cadran, the lights of the palace shone brightly. From the open and welcoming doors, magical illumination spilled out onto the marble-paved road that ran past the entrance, where carriages deposited their various personages of royal invitation. To be welcomed at the palace that night, one had to either be a noble, a head of one of the trade guilds, a knight, or a member of the imperial circle. There was a line of carriages out front as guests awaited their turn to disembark. Those among the guests who lived closer sometimes walked and thus avoided the long wait for the carriages to unload. In all, there were likely to be over 500 in attendance before guests stopped filling the palace ballroom. Rashan watched the procession from the shadows near the entrance gate, far from the doors of the palace but close to where the carriages passed as they entered the grounds. He kept an idle count of the conveyances as they passed, but was mostly looking to see what sort of folk were running the empire nowadays. There was only so much one could gather from the partygoers at a revel. But at least Rashan saw that the empire appeared to be prospering. The guests were bedecked in expensive-looking finery, almost without exception. The only ones who seemed to be dressed in less than extravagant luxury were some of the younger members of the circle, and a few knights and nobles from less well-off families. There were two in particular that Rashan watched for.
And he was disappointed on one count.
He saw Iridan later on toward the end of the guests' arrivals, on foot. He supposed the lad must have had to scramble to prepare, given that they had arrived only earlier in the day. Rashan smiled when he saw Iridan's costume. While most of the sorcerers of the circle were dressing as knights, Iridan was in a squire's garb. Rashan applauded him for having the humility to poke fun at his own inexperience. He saw, too, that Iridan was alone. While it was certainly not unheard of to attend a ball unescorted, Rashan had rather hoped Iridan would have had time to find someone to take.
I shall have to do something about that. He ought to have been arranged to someone by now. Can they not see how exceptional he is?
As the last of the carriages finally left, Rishon made his way to the entrance. He strode confidently across the lawns of the palace, taking the shortest distance rather than following the curve of the road. With his cloak flowing out behind him and Heaven's Cry bouncing at his hip, nearly dragging on the ground, he was like an apparition from the past. Ever mindful of the Empire's best interests, even in small matters, he kept his feet from touching the grass as he walked. The entrance was guarded, but ceremonially so. With everyone in costume, a pair of armored simpletons could hardly tell that one petite warlock did not belong at the party. The guards would have prevented drunken peasants from wandering in, but Rishon needed no magic to slip by them without raising their suspicions. The herald, however, was another story. The wizened old man whose voice called out the names of those who entered made a career of knowing who belonged in the palace, with emphasis on knowing who belonged at the various revels. "Sir, I do not know you," the herald told Rishon, stepping into the warlock's path. "Might you enlighten me such that you may be properly introduced?" While his words were formal and said in the most polite tone, there was a clear implication that Rishon was in the wrong. "What is your name, herald? I would properly address you before I give mine." Rishon wanted to know this man, whom he expected he would deal with much more once he slipped back into palace life on the emperor's staff. He could easily have befuddled him with magic, but chose not to. Some were a bit more sensitive to it than others. And even if he did not recall being inspelled, the herald would deduce it later when talk of a gatecrasher spread throughout the city. "I am Lawnford, sir, royal herald," he nodded graciously and expectantly. "If you have had cause to visit the sanctum in the Tower of Contemplation, you may recognize my face. I am Rishon Solaran, warlock of the Empire, high sorcerer, and the blood-stained right hand of the Emperor. I have been away a long time, and it is a tale I have no time to tell now. I am home now, and intend to resume my service to the Emperor and to the Empire." Rishon drew his sword as slowly and non-threateningly as he could manage, pulling it with his off hand and grip reversed, cradling it along his right arm as he pulled the blade free of its sheath. He used his magic to levitate the blade in front of Lawnford for inspection. "This is Heaven's Cry. No crude copy, but the real blade itself, forged by my hand. Tonight is my first night back in Cadrus, and since it happens to be Bygone's night, I plan to make the Inner Circle a peace offering, for the best interest of the Empire. I will, however, leave it to your discretion whether you would like to announce me, with the title as I gave it to you, or just allow me to enter unannounced." "What game do you play at, sir? I will not be made a fool of." Lawnford sounded indignant, but maintained his temper. "No game, Lawnford. I am back. My magic has kept me alive longer than any of my predecessors, and I have been away for too long, but I am here, and I am indeed Rishon Solaran," Rishon told him in a calm tone. He thought he might be able to convince the old herald, or he would not have bothered talking to him at all. "I do know your face. I am a student of Cadran history, of course. You know that if you were using magic to look like him, scores of sorcerers inside, including all the Inner Circle, will see right through you," Lawnford said. Rishon merely nodded slightly in reply. "And you are not worried?" Rishon shook his head, just barely. Lawnford swallowed visibly. "Very well." Rishon followed Lawnford down the short hall to the ballroom. The sounds of flutes and drums and lutes wafted in as they approached, as well as the general din of 100 conversations taking place. At the entrance of the room, Lawnford paused, turned, and looked askance at Rishon. The warlock nodded in reply. "I present Rishon Solaran, warlock of the Empire, high sorcerer, and the blood-stained right hand of the Emperor." Lawnford winced as he added the last part, though he no doubt knew that it was nearly as good as an official part of the title. The music played on, but the conversations halted as if they had tripped. Rashan looked out into the sea of men and women who represented the elite class of the empire. The sorcerers were decked out in parchment-thin armor of silver or gold, with fanciful and mirthful crests emblazoned on their tabards. Most of the would-be knights carried thin, dull swords made of cheap steel, and a few had on fake mustaches to poke fun at the knightly pretense of neatly groomed facial hair, in which so many indulged. The knights, for the most part, were dressed in what appeared to be ill-fitted bed linens,
with necklaces of dangling baubles and pointed hats that had fallen out of fashion before even Rashan's time,
with everyone except those who wished to lampoon sorcerous pomp. The nobles and merchants Rashan could hardly tell apart, for they tended to focus on more specific impersonations, and by his accounting there was little difference between the two groups. The nobles were greedy, manipulative snakes who felt they were superior by birthright. The merchants were greedy, manipulative snakes who felt that they were superior because they were good at being greedy, manipulative snakes. The ladies present were mostly not costumed as such. It was unbefitting a lady of standing to admit to having rivals, and if they were to, they would have had to have been forced to dress much the same regardless. The exception to this were the ladies of the imperial circle, who were dressed as knights, much like their male colleagues. The women sorcerers of the empire had even better cause to satirize the knighthood, as there were no women among their ranks. Everyone enjoyed the sight of the ladies' armor and the very large, often magically lightened swords they carried. All these various people stopped and stared up at the entrance where Rashan stood smiling, giving the impression of being happily returned to them after a long time away. Most of those doing the staring were surprised and confused. The name was familiar to everyone, though some of the poorer students of history might not quite have recalled from where. The sorcerers of the inner circle were aghast. While they knew that Rashan, or at least someone claiming to be him, had returned to the empire, they all believed that person to be safely stowed away in the most secure cell they had. One person, and only one person, was not surprised at all that he had escaped imprisonment. Iridan merely sighed and hoped he was not going to kill anyone. While the entrance was up several steps from the ballroom floor, Rashan's lack of height meant that only those nearest the entrance saw that he was armed. None of those close enough recognized the weapon for anything but a prop, at least as far as they let on. As he descended down into the crowd, a few conversations started back up, and some took on a whole new tenor as the guests speculated as to what was transpiring. Rashan smiled and nodded, acknowledging any who made eye contact with him. He picked his way through the crowd until someone approached him.
"What are you playing at?"
growled Gravis Arkon under his breath from just inches away from Rashan. He was wearing plate armor and a green tabard with a crest that depicted a fat, sleeping bear, and wore a rapier on his belt that was twisted like a corkscrew and flopped a bit as he walked.
"That is the second time someone has suggested that this is a game. While I will admit to enjoying myself thus far on my return home, this is no game. If you wish to hear the long and sordid tale of my time outside the Empire, I shall tell it sometime. But for now, just know this. I am back, and I intend to stay."
"So you think you can just walk back from a century of neglecting the Empire and be welcomed as a returning hero?" "If you really are, Rashan, you have become a fool," Gravis replied.
Rashan just looked up and down at Gravis's outfit and smiled, cocking his head as if to say, "Which of us looks the fool?"
Gravis frowned.
"You make light of this? Is this all a farce to you? You cannot expect me to be convinced you are our long-dead warlock by acting the jester.
You were just a boy. You never knew me. But I was always the jester. You can only surround your heart with so much death without it consuming you. However, if you would like a more serious topic, who has been in my room?" Rashan asked. For the first time, it seemed he had hit his mark.
Gravis's face went ashen.
What do you mean, who's been in your room?
I mean, I went up there to retrieve some of my old things, and I found something missing. Someone besides me has been in there.
You got into Rashan's chambers? Gravis asked in a hushed tone. That lock has thwarted all attempts at entry since he died.
My chambers? And of course I got in. I hardly have to think about it to disarm the wards. But someone has gotten in. You do not know who that might have been by any chance. Oh, and while we are being incredulous, I worked on the wards in the dungeon. Getting out of there was simple as well. Rashan felt he had Gravis convinced now.
As I said, no one has gotten in to the best of my knowledge. We have tried here and there, but it is a puzzle. There's a standing offer of immediate graduation for any student of the academy who can get in there. Can you prove you actually got in? Gravis asked.
Iridan had quietly made his way within earshot of the conversation, and he was very curious to hear the answer to that one as well. First of all, the costume is actually the genuine article. Look at the ether and you will see it. He paused briefly as Gravis Archon concentrated. And while you are noticing that the garments are unaltered, please note that I am immortal, he added casually. Gravis frowned slightly, and his eyes unfocused.
You are a demon, Gravis gasped,
taking a quick half-step backward. His coiled sword bounced comically in response. How else would I still be alive? I am 247 summers old, unless I lost track somewhere along the way. You are less than half my age, and showing your winters, Rashan said. Despite the vast difference in age, Rashan indeed looked barely past adolescence, and Gravis appeared at least thrice his age. Oh, I might add that I figured out where you had hidden this. He patted Heaven's Cry at his hip. Gravis's eyes widened as he realized what weapon the demon was carrying. You really should not have given it to poor Brannis to drag around. With no ether to control it, it must have been as dangerous to his men as it was to his enemies.
You have broken Heaven's Cry loose of its bindings? Why?
Gravis seemed perplexed. Several of the inner circle were hovering nearby now, listening in and ready to intervene if necessary. Iridan noticed them and kept back just a little farther than the subtle circle they had formed, a short way from the two senior sorcerers. First of all, because it's mine. Secondly, because I think it helps bolster my case for my identity. Thirdly, because there is the small chance that some fool one of you is going to try to attack me and embolden the others to do likewise, Rashan answered simply. While I think I would be able to defend myself even without it, I prefer to have more weaponry than I need, rather than less.
So you expect us to take you back? Just like that? You make a strong case. You certainly know things that Rashan Solaran should know. But you still may have come by this knowledge by other means, demon.
Gravis tried to hold his ground in an argument he was clearly losing. Whispered conversations were taking place behind him, among the inner circle and many of the other guests who had been drawn away from the music, food, and dancing by the High Sorcerer's meeting with one of the Empire's ghosts. A draw, then, Rashan said. I challenge you, here and now, for leadership of the circle. By rights, I should not even have to, but I shall prove my point. There should be water enough in the fountains out front to soak up your spent ether at the end. Rashan smiled,
baiting the High Sorcerer.
Iridan's eyes widened, and a smile grew on his face, unbidden. Now that would be a sight to remember, a draw between Rashan and Gravis Archon.
Cut that pompous old fool's ego to shreds, Rashan, Iridan wished.
Iridan had always loved a good draw, even as a young student at the academy. It had been a late morning on that day not so many autumns ago, and the fog had just lifted on Dragon Lake and the surrounding countryside. The academy lay just on the north side of the lake,
That day, on the grounds overlooking the water, the faculty and student body of the academy were gathered, along with many curious onlookers from the palace and army. It was ranking day. Students below the age of 14 were ranked solely on their academic success. But thereafter, each springtime the students would compete in a draw to see who would be first among them, and second and third and so forth down to the bottom of the class. They would compete both against students their own age and against the whole student body. It had long been considered essential to bringing out the best in the top students, to force them to compete against one another. It was to be the last day Brannis spent at the Imperial Academy, as it was the first time he had been eligible for ranking day and took part in his first and only draw. It was the day he had to make the painful admission before everyone that he was not only incapable of competing, but of even properly witnessing the event. He was no better than the knights and courtiers who came just for the excitement and to see who were the up-and-comers among the young sorcerers. After a single bout, he accepted a disqualification and the bottom rank in the academy, rather than be trotted out to be defeated repeatedly by the weakest students in the class until it was certain he was worst. That same evening, High Sorcerer Gravis Archon would take Brannis aside to test him for any sign at all of hope for his magical abilities, and finally give up on him. For Iridan, however, it was a day of glory. He had been a modest student, competent but unexceptional, solidly lodged in the middle of his class. He was a nobody, from a family with no history of magical aptitude, and despite showing promise, he had never been taken terribly seriously. He was the sort of student that ranking day was created for. The draw was a civilized sorcerer's alternative to dueling. Two sorcerers stood a short distance apart in an area of sufficient and reasonably balanced ether. A number of other sorcerers stood in attendance, and either one sorcerer or a small group of them would stand in judgment. At the command to begin, each combatant would draw as much ether as he or she could. As the two drew ether in, the judges would watch for a current to form in the ether, showing who had the more powerful draw. If one was clearly the stronger, the flow of ether would be noticeably stronger toward that sorcerer. If the two were closely matched, small interferences from outside the competition would make it too close to determine a winner by flow alone. If such was the case, as the ether in the immediate area began to be used up, one judge would declare a hold. At that point, each sorcerer stopped gathering in ether and tried to contain what they had drawn for as long as possible. The first one to need to release ether, either during the hold or any time before, was declared the loser. Large quantities of water were always on hand in case the sorcerers were unable to use the ether productively in a spell. As for Iridan, he had spent the morning embarrassing his classmates and had carved a swath through the older students as well. The ability to draw ether could be improved over time with practice and techniques, but much of it was raw natural ability, which, as it turned out, Iridan possessed by the wagon load. The first matches had been uncompetitive, with the judges quickly awarding victories from a clear dominance of the flow of ether shortly after the matches had begun. The students his age fell by the wayside, with only a couple putting up much resistance. He was glad that one of the other students had eliminated Brannis, because that was a match he had not relished having to win. Once he got paired with the older students, he found the going a little more difficult, but not difficult enough to actually cause him to lose. Iridan was still drawing ether faster than any of them, and he had yet to have a hold called. There was a satisfaction that few could understand when a boy of no family worth noting defeated an Archon or a Gardarus or a Solaran, or any boy or girl who had grown up with every advantage granted by a sorceress bloodline. It felt good putting a few of them in their place. Iridan's last opponent now stood across from him. It was Garalos Gardarus, a lad of 17, whom Iridan hardly knew. 3 summers older, Garrulos was hardly one to socialize with a young boy with no social connections. He was a bookish sort, solidly built, but not what one would ever confuse with muscular, with intense brown eyes and a round face. He had been having just as easy a time of it as Iridan, except he'd had fewer age groups to advance through, starting as he was in the eldest rank of the academy.
"Begin,"
High Sorcerer Gravis had announced. Both boys drew ether as fast as they were able. Iridan noticed immediately that he was being outdrawn, and he redoubled his efforts. The older boy probably held a small advantage over him, but the judges were always careful not to call a bout too early if it was close. The hold was a much more reliable method of determining a winner. When Iridan got the sense that a hold was coming, he eased off just a little, hoping to have to contain less ether than his opponent. It was a sound strategy and more often used by the one winning, but Iridan found that as he backed off, so did Garrulos.
"Hold," came the call, as both had expected.
Iridan quickly stopped drawing ether. It was more than he had ever held. He knew it was more than was safe to hold. He trusted that all the senior members of the Imperial Circle were there and would rush to the aid of either participant if there was an accident, but he did not want to lose like that. He calmed himself and tried to hold in the ether that rushed around within his source, a throbbing, pulsating, burning sensation. It felt like taking a mouthful of stew that was too hot and only grew hotter. Iridan tried to focus on just his own predicament, but he could not help but keep an eye on his opponent. Garrulos was clearly straining, and Iridan watched to see when he would fail. Built up with confidence from a dozen and more bouts already, it did not occur to Iridan that he might go down first. Suddenly, Garrulos lurched forward. Plumes of steam jetted up from the large basins that stood behind him. Iridan was declared victorious, and a cheer rang up from the audience. The academy's top-ranked student had been determined. But Iridan was not done yet. He had been practicing something special all on his own. The students of his rank had been taught the basic concepts of silent casting, but no more. Iridan had taken that lesson well to heart, however, and practiced a few spells until he was rather good with them silently. Ever since he began winning earlier in the morning, he had started planning what he would do if he won. Iridan calmed himself as best as he could and bled a little ether out into the basins where Garrulos had just dumped all the ether he had held. It was just enough to regain control from the edge of feeling like he was about to explode, and he had used Garrulos's basins instead of his own, just to keep up appearances a bit.
"Canithio Mandraxe," he thought, but did not say aloud.
He felt his palms crossed in front of him, but did not move them. He felt the spell about to take hold and thrust his fist into the air. The crowd gasped as an impressive ether bolt sundered the sky, leaving a hole in the clouds above and letting in a small ray of sunshine on the overcast morning. The cheering erupted anew, and his best friend Brannis rushed out to crush him in a hug, then lifted him up on his shoulder. People crowded in to congratulate him. It had been the best day of his life.
Iridan found himself very much hoping the High Sorcerer would accept Rashan's challenge. Iridan loved the spectacle of a draw and even went back to the academy each ranking day to watch. He often made some spare coin betting on the contests. A contest between Rashan and Gravis was one he would pay a month's wage for the privilege of watching.
"I think not," Gravis replied,
and more than just Iridan were within earshot and disappointed by the news.
"We can discuss the matter further tomorrow in the sanctum. If you can offer further evidence to back your claim, we will hear it then."
"Would you not rather settle the matter right now and be done with it?" Rashan said. There was a hungry look in Rashan's eyes that betrayed how much he wanted to confront the High Sorcerer.
"I wonder how many men have died with their last sight being that look on his face," Iridan mused.
"No, and since you seem to prefer such responses, I shall list why. Firstly, I have nothing to gain in victory. I would only achieve a stalemate. Secondly, I am aware of the history of how you came to be warlock, and will not repeat that mistake.
To which Roshan averted his gaze and looked sincerely chastened.
And thirdly, it is bygone's night, which is anathema to the draw. Now, if you will pardon me.
My wife would much enjoy my company for the rest of the evening.
With that, Gravis turned away from Roshan. Iridan was impressed, despite hoping for the confrontation that apparently was not forthcoming. He had yet to see anyone best Roshan at wordplay, despite he and Brannis being around each other so much, and Brannis being pretty good at twisting people around in conversation. "Have you seen the Emperor?" Roshan called after him. "I had hoped to present myself to him tonight." Gravis spoke over his shoulder as he walked away.
"Emperor Darris does not like these affairs. He keeps to himself, mostly."
Frowning, Roshan set off to make the acquaintance of the important personages of the modern empire. Iridan followed after and caught up with him. "I had really hoped to see you draw against the High Sorcerer," he said. "I bet you would have beaten him." "Of course I would have. You yourself could offer him a challenge. I was just offering a quick answer to the mystery he does not want solved, and I would have offered it up with a fistful of humiliation. However, I was not planning to kill him," Roshan said.
"Why would you kill him?"
Iridan asked, puzzled.
"I knew you overheard the second reason he gave. I assumed you knew the story. I skipped my final two ranks at the academy to become warlock and enter the Emperor's service. On ranking day, after brushing aside all the students, I called out the High Sorcerer, my grandfather, and challenged him to a draw. Well, he cursed me and insulted me, but he could not rightly refuse. He did take the time to remind me of the only previous time a student had challenged a member of the circle. In that case, one of the faculty of the academy. That draw had resulted in the faculty member winning, and he used his stored ether to kill the student where he stood for his impudence. Well, I took that poorly, and when I bested High Sorcerer Kormar Solaran, I blasted him to ash. Then I went over to the Emperor and offered him my services as warlock. Escalon IV liked the thought of having a warlock and had never gotten on well with Kormar. So that was that. I made many enemies that day, but I made the only ally that mattered. Gravis obviously suspected he was to play the part of Kormar tonight. Sadly, I just wanted to prove a point. I have no grudge with him, despite the whole incident with the dungeon earlier. I practically goaded him into it.
So what will you do now? Iridan asked.
Well, the hour is late. If he's not attending the revel, I will not disturb the Emperor tonight. I shall see him in the morning, Roshan said, shrugging nonchalantly.
I do not think the Emperor is in Cadrus, Iridan interrupted. He is likely at his seaside palace this time of autumn.
Roshan frowned. If I set out tonight, I could make it there on foot by morning.
Iridan gave him a skeptical look.
I would prefer to skip dealing with Gravis and just have the Emperor reinstate me, Roshan said. Even peace-loving Tamron would not have refused the services of a warlock, wanted more like me, even, to defend the Empire. This Emperor Darris will surely prove reasonable. If you'll excuse me.
Roshan nodded to Iridan and started for the door.
Oh, and Iridan, try to find some company. This is a revel.
Roshan smiled back at him as he made his exit.